Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Well, it's been about 6 years since we first heard of super shoes in running, and that's when Nike developed their new Vaporfly, which sent many of the athletics people around the world, not only runners but organizations and World Athletics and all the other brands, into a frenzy of rules and all sorts of things that they had to control, because these shoes came along and they decided that we could see straight away that the results of those shoes were that runners could run faster using the mechanical advantage of a shoe. And as a result of that, there were lots of things that happened around World Athletics, where World Athletics then had to put a whole bunch of rules in place ahead of the Olympics in Tokyo in 2020, which essentially happened in 2021. And those rules made sure that those competitors that participated in the shoes, all those shoes were available and freely available to everybody, but there were rules limiting what technology could be used. Ross, is that a fair summary of how you can describe the onset of the super shoe era of road running shoes?
Yeah, fair enough. I reckon it's probably a straight line summary of something that actually went round in circles a lot of the time back then. But that's pretty much the gist of it.
Mm. Now, what was interesting is that when we did our first podcast on this 3 years ago now, we were almost sort of a year and a half afterwards. The impact of the shoe had been felt quite strongly in terms of marathon and road running events. And obviously that technology then went into track spikes. And obviously there was an advantage there as well in terms of track spike and that sort of thing. But what was interesting and what the controversy was that when the World Athletics came up with the guidelines as to what shoe manufacturers could do, 40 millimeters of stack height, the carbon footplate, all that sort of thing, it literally was almost exactly what Nike had done with the shoe. And all the other competitors, the Adidas's and the Pumas and the Under Armours and all those sort of brands, then sort of cried foul and said, well, you're basically given guidelines that give Nike such a massive advantage that it's going to take us 2 years to catch up.
Yeah, so it's quite clear Nike had first mover advantage on this, and we'll discover more about that in an interview you'll play for us shortly. Other brands can claim all they want that they were on the same trajectory, but the fact of the matter is Nike got to the, whether you call it the finish line or the start line, quite a lot before them. I suppose the issue there was there was no regulation in place before. So there was no mechanism by which the authorities could evaluate a new piece of equipment, which is different from most other sports, but not the first time a sport has been caught out by this. The swimming world went through a similar thing back in 2008, where they had to effectively create guidelines in response to technological innovation. And that's eventually where track and field got to. And I remember even before World Athletics brought out those guidelines, there was a paper by Jeff Burns, who was one of the people we interviewed on this podcast about it, and a PhD student of mine called Nick Tam. Well, he was a PhD student. He's now finished his PhD. And they were the ones who wrote about regulating stack height. Because, in fact, I think even in our first podcast, we were talking about regulating the content, you know, the carbon fiber plate and so on. And I think Greg and Nick certainly persuaded me that you really just have to regulate the stack height, because otherwise you create for yourself a regulatory challenge that probably can't be met by all but a few races in the world. Because then you've got to cut the shoe open, or you've got to do an MRI on the shoe. I mean, this is like Formula One levels in a simple... That's the beauty of running, is its simplicity. So
just explain why... I mean, this is what I don't understand, is that when we look at the technology, there was two principal components to this new technology. First of all, the carbon plate inside the shoe.
Yeah.
And the second part was the foam. And obviously the foam created more rebounding effect. And obviously the bigger stack height gave you more rebounding. But obviously it was offset by a weight cost. And we'll talk a little bit about that a bit later on. Why was the stack height important in terms of not letting things get out of control. I don't understand the technical reason why the stakeout was important.
I don't think, to be honest, I don't think anyone does. You know, I found a paper a week and a half ago that was published in Footwear Science very recently. This is a journal that publishes a lot of stuff on shoes, not just running, but for instance, we funded a study at rugby on how the stud orientation changes the forces on the knee for ACL injuries, etc. Anyway, Footwear Science, good journal. And this one was called The Nike Vaporfly 4%, A Game Changer to Improve Performance Without Biomechanical Explanation. It was published by four French authors, and effectively the paper, it's one of those classic academic things that writes a lot to say we know very little.
And but it does give you actual numbers, doesn't it?
Some. But anyway, the point is that there is still a fair amount that is unknown about how the shoe works. But I think it's fair to say, you're right, there are two ingredients and three elements. The ingredients are the carbon plate and the midsole foam, and the element is the stack height. And you see, the midsole foam enabled the stack height. Because in the past, midsole foam was heavier, or you could make it really light, but then it wasn't resilient. It would just be compliant and you'd squash it under your feet and you get no energy return at all. What we've got now is midsole foam that returns more energy than anything ever before, and it's light. And it's got no density. So that allowed you to build up volume without mass. Make sense?
Right. Yeah.
And volume was important because it allowed you to create in the midsole what was effectively a scaffold for the carbon fiber plate. Because carbon fiber plates aren't new. They've been around since the 90s. Fila had a shoe. Adidas had something called the Pro Plate, which you discuss within this week, leading into this interview. But the problem was that the plates weren't achieving a net benefit because there was a trade-off where you saved a little bit of energy here or there, like at the toes, for instance, from a plate, and you had a longer lever, a stiffer lever, but the work done at the ankle was suddenly a lot higher. And so whatever benefit you got in A was cancelled out by some cost incurred at B. Make sense?
And B was often a weight
B was a weight issue because of the midsole costs. Yeah. And then with the carbon fiber plates, it was the length of the lever arm and the stiffness created work at the ankle, basically, to give you the summary of it. What the thicker midsole and that stack height enabled was a curvature of the plate that seems to have eliminated that cost. So there was no longer a trade-off. You got the benefit of energy saving in one place, but you didn't incur a cost elsewhere. So now it was only good news.
Yeah,
and so the three things together, the foam enabled a stack height that enabled a plate that didn't create problems.
Yeah,
and it was those three things in one package that had never been achieved before. So that was the innovative breakthrough. Was foam opened a door. Through that door, we drove a bus called a carbon fiber plate. And by blending the three elements together, we got more energy return than any shoe ever did. And that's where it's fascinating to wonder whether the other five or six big shoe companies were on the same journey or whether they were going somewhere else and then said, hang on a moment, we've actually taken a wrong turn. We need to be on that path. And then they imitated. Did they imitate?
Are we going to find out about that pretty soon?
Or did they, you know, in other words, was it from scratch imitation, reverse engineer, or were they simply accelerated along what they were already doing? That to me is quite interesting. But I mean, looking back on it now, this year we've had COVID did many things, and I suppose in the grand scheme, it's innocuous. But the interruption to the world marathon scene is quite frustrating because we haven't seen how this would have played out without it, you know? Because as you said in your intro, there was a time when if you weren't in the Vaporfly, you weren't winning a race. The difference between the difference between the shoes was bigger than the difference between athletes. Mm-hmm. And the best athletes were going to be the ones in that shoe. We didn't get to see how that came back to normal, or did it? Now we've got marathons again, and we're seeing athletes in Adidas shoes and other shoes that are now Asics, for instance, breaking national course records, winning races. So at surface level, it looks like there's a degree of parity. But the reality is the sport has been recalibrated. I mean, there's no doubt that a 204 marathon from 6-7 years ago is a 202 marathon now, and a 207 is now a 204. So
you were quoted, I think, in an article that I saw online saying that you estimated the physical output Kipchoge needed for his 201.39, which he did on the road, world record in the Nike Vaporfly, equated to a 203 marathon in regular
That's yeah, and that's, I mean, no one knew. No one, yeah, more or less. More I mean, less, I stand by it vaguely. I don't remember saying that, by the way. I sometimes
well, you're credited as saying that.
I sometimes go in and I read articles on things that I'm interested in and I see a quote and I, and it's from me and I go, wow, I don't remember
that's
saying that.
That's a good
that.
Quote.
Anyway, that's one of them.
Because it's interesting, some of the stats, I mean, some of the stats that I've looked up is that in the Valencia Marathon in I think, 2019, 95 of the first 100 finishers were wearing Vaporfly shoes. And when you looked at the analysis of the world rankings, that in 2019, twice as many men ran under 210 and twice as many women ran under 227 as compared to 2016. And 8 of the 12 fastest men's marathons in history had been run in that last year. So it showed you the impact of those shoes. And that research study that you mentioned, that was the first research study that gave a sort of a fairly objective measuring of the advantage of these mechanical shoes. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the 4% name came from lab studies where they'd found that when you ran at a given speed, and it was quite a healthy pace these guys ran at in that first study, you used 4% less oxygen. Now, the inference you make is that if I can run the same speed at 4% less oxygen, I'm going to get some performance benefit. But it's not necessarily 4% because it doesn't translate one-to-one. So when that first study came out, it's like, all right, 4%, but what does that really mean? And it's only been through the trial by fire, trial by stopwatch that racing creates that you've been able to quantify it properly. You know, New York Times did a big analysis based on Strava times they got hold of, and they showed that it was, I think, between 1% and 2% performance. And there's no doubt that an elite athlete is getting a benefit that is less than 4%. I mean, 4% takes a 204 to sub 2, right? I think that's too much.
Sure.
But it's not. So the elite athlete's getting less than 4, but in my opinion, certainly more than 1.
Yeah.
And so probably between 1 and 2. And that's where that estimate of mine came from. Track, by the way, is similar. I mean, there was an analysis that was done recently in the U.S., where in each of the last 10 years, 32 college-aged men have run a sub-4-minute mile. Last year was 38. This year there are 90. Now that's – so again, a sub-4-minute mile used to put you in the top 30. It now puts you in the top 90. That's the definition of recalibrating.
Yeah.
And it just means it's less valuable. So – maybe nowadays the top 38 run sub 358. So 358 is worth a 4 from 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what it's done. Mm. So now we move on with the assumption that there's parity. I'm still not convinced. I'm still not convinced that the same type of runner benefits, because there is some evidence that's emerged. Another thing COVID has done is it stopped studies from being done. Because you couldn't test humans. There was a lockdown and you couldn't get people in the lab and test these shoes. So I think in the next year or two, we'll see an exponential increase in the studies on the shoes.
Yeah.
A, because there's more of the shoes, and B, more studies. But there was a study that suggested that a rear foot striker would get a greater benefit than a forefoot striker. So in effect, how the athlete interacts with the shoe becomes an element of talent ID.
Because the technology itself was what they called the teeter-totter effect, isn't it?
It's like a seesaw. One mechanism, yeah.
So in other words, you create the sort of, when you land on the heel, then it bounds you forward as if you were on a seesaw, and basically that weight goes forward and then pushes the other person as you would on a seesaw. It pushes you forward.
And that is your first experience of the shoe. You would have tried them on.
I've never tried a pair of Vaporflies on, but I have tried some of the Adidas shoes.
Yeah.
And
so when I was in the first opportunity I got, I went to the store in London and I tried it on. And that's literally what you feel. You feel like you're being rocked forward on the shoe. Do. It's like walking down a flight of stairs and you're walking across flat ground. That's what it felt like to me. My weight was being propelled forward. So that's why it's not surprising people say, oh, it's a spring, because it feels like it's springing you forward. Mm. It's not, well, it is a spring because it's returning energy. That's what springs do. But it's not a pogo stick.
No.
But it's – so anyway, that teeter-totter effect is one of the three or four mechanisms that it's thought to work through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to give you some background, there was a story about the Brooks Running Group, and obviously Brooks, a massive brand in the US in particular, I think one of the leading, if not the leading running shoe brand, and a gentleman by the name of Carson Caprara, who was the head of footwear development for Brooks Running, in the Turkey Olympics in the 1500-meter final, their star athlete, a gentleman by the name of Josh Kerr, got the bronze medal. And obviously they should have been celebrating that, but he was running in a pair of Nike spikes at that time because Brooks's technology hadn't caught up with the trend. And I think it's a good indication of the kind of pressure that the big shoe brands were on around the world, given what Nike had done. And we've seen stories since then talking about how Nike as a brand, and Nike said its market share in running reached a record high in 2021 as a result of the Vaporfly sales. So it wasn't just the fact that they were producing great athletes, but actually commercially, it was an incredibly good thing because it put them at the top of the pile. Mm. Everybody wanted their shoes. They were the fastest shoes in the market. And even though other brands were catching up, there were shoes that you could wear as a non-professional that would give you an advantage. And yeah, Adidas also got those shoes.
I mean, if you got 2.5% and you were a 21 minute 5K park runner, that shoe is going to help you get under 20 minutes.
Under 20 minutes, yeah.
So there's a little bit of, I mean, who cares, right? But you do.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've been in the industry long enough that you would have seen dozens of promises made by shoes. So the initial stages was, here we go again, you know, another promise.
Absolutely.
But you see, then what they had was a billboard in the form of that sub-2 marathon thing at Monza.
Mm.
They then repeated that with an even bigger billboard at the one that was eventually done in Vienna, where it successfully came off. And those were a showcase for the shoe. They had Kipchoge and a bunch of pacemakers, and it was all, I mean, as a marketing exercise.
Brilliant marketing exercise. But even though it didn't succeed the first time round, it was good marketing. And of course, when it succeeded the second time round, it was even better. Yeah.
So, see, I mean, none of it would, marketing fails when there's no product, no substance behind it.
Mm.
Okay, it doesn't fail, but it wouldn't have done this.
Mm.
So, yeah, they remember there were cases of, I forget when it was, it would have been 2018 or 19, Ethiopian marathon runner, I think it was, had painted Adidas stripes over a Nike shoe.
Yeah.
Because obviously they hadn't received the overt permission that Josh Kerr got that you just mentioned. But the runners knew. They knew that if I wasn't in this shoe, I wouldn't be competitive. Jeff told us that in the interview we did with him, because he himself is an elite ultra endurance athlete. And he said, if I wanted a realistic chance of winning, for instance, our Comrades Marathon South Africa, I'd be in that shoe.
Yeah.
Because if I wasn't, I might as well give everyone a 2 kilometer head start.
Yeah.
That's what it literally amounted
That's
to.
That's what it amounted to.
You know, exactly. You know, 4% economy difference is the equivalent of running down 0.5% to a 1% gradient.
Mm.
So the other way to think of it is you're running a flat marathon and everyone else is running a slightly downhill one.
Yeah.
Do you want to take your chances or do you want to help join the downhill club?
Yeah.
So that's what it did, you know. And
anyway,
people forget now. But I don't think they've recalibrated. I mean, I see their reaction to certain performances. It's as if it meant the same as it did 6 years ago.
Yeah.
But we've clearly moved on. You know, that 38 now plays 90.
Yeah.
It's a massive effect.
Yeah. But I guess to some extent it's also made athletics and road running a bit more exciting in respect to the fact that they are breaking all these records. So people are running faster. Yes, as people listening to this podcast and you and I, people who know the sport, will say, yes, the technological advantages are obviously playing a massive role in this. But we are breaking records and it creates good vibes, I think, for marathon running and any other kind of running.
And we'll hear that again later. But for me, I still think it's a net negative for the sport because I'm an old-fashioned Luddite when it comes to tech. You know, the biggest problem for me is like Formula One is a cool showcase of tech, but I don't take seriously the driver ranking.
Yes.
Because the problem
Lewis Hamilton's doing nothing this year because he's in the wrong car.
So the greatest ever is – and I get things change, but the same conversation is true of Schumacher, and it would have been true of the next guy and so on. You know, like the problem that I think there is that the difference between two cars is bigger than the difference between two drivers.
Mm.
And so you can't evaluate. Whereas when I'm watching – last point, I was watching tennis last night, the night before. I never once think if these players just swapped rackets – Nadal would win, Djokovic would have beaten Nadal last night. I'd never, ever think that.
Mm.
But unfortunately, I'm still thinking that about the shoes, and that to me is not ideal. But I get that there are positive elements to it.
And I guess that the naysayers will suggest that technology is part of sport, but as you've suggested correctly there, tennis is one of those where the technology is pretty much the same for everybody, so you're playing player against player. And I guess even for sports like cycling essentially, yes, there are technological advancements, but in a Tour de France, somebody riding one team's bike versus another team's bike, the gains are very marginal between those two kinds of bike, whether they're riding a Specialized or a Pinarello.
So you don't watch the Giro d'Italia and say, yes, if Carapaz had a Specialized as opposed to the Pinarello, he would have won that day. He would have hung on to Hendley at the end there, you know?
Yeah.
I read that Colnago are going to bring out a new climbing bike for the Tour de France. I don't go, oh man, that's going to make it even more difficult to beat Pogacar.
No.
And that's how I want these sports
so
to be.
Yeah.
Formula One is the opposite, because there, new technology coming out. Oh, Ferrari's got something new. That's quite exciting, because now it's a race. It's a showcase for the tech. Sports, in my opinion, these sports shouldn't be that. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I'm sure that lots of you may disagree or agree with Professor Ross Tucker on that point. It is a very controversial one. But let's get into the interview. And this is why everything we've been discussing so far is a precursor to an interview I did with Simon Lockett, who is the category director for Adidas Running, the racing footwear category. And Simon leads the overall strategy for product creation and go-to-market approach for both Adizero Racing Footwear and the Derama franchise, which is all part of the Adidas brand. And I was a guest of Adidas. They took me over to their big headquarters in Herzo in Germany a couple of weeks back. And we got to chat to not only Simon and the team, but we got to see the very confidential training facility that they have. So when you go in there, you're not allowed to take photographs, you're not allowed to take any notes. And when we were doing this interview, because there was a lot of secrecy around the new super shoes that they were bringing out, which ironically had been used on the footwear of the runners who did the race records literally a couple of hours earlier, we weren't allowed to mention the new shoes. But there's a lot of secrecy. There's a lot of rooms that you have to go in and leave all your equipment behind and all that sort of thing. It feels very clandestine in some respects. Mm. But it shows you the level of which they want to keep things quite under wraps. And they're very careful about what they sort of show. And when we did the interview with Simon, full disclosure here, we had a PR person in there making sure that Simon didn't say anything wrong about new shoes that came out. And as you'll hear in the interview, and I know Ross has listened to the interview, and just as we build up towards the podcast, and we're probably going to interrupt sections of the interview to sort of look at what Simon was saying. But what's interesting is that we asked him pretty direct questions, but he probably doesn't answer them quite as directly as we would like him to answer them back to us, particularly around their reaction to the Nike shoes, because that was the key question. Did they respond to Nike? And you'll see Simon kind of avoids that subject a little bit. But let's listen to Simon.
So just on that, as a general theme, because the way, as you've just said, we're going to play the interview and interrupt it possibly quite often whenever one of us has a comment in response to what we hear. And I'll be interested to know, like, because I could see where you were going with the questions, and he was ducking and diving like Muhammad Ali on a rope.
Well, he had a PR person looking down.
And I'd be interested to know what your thoughts were at the time. So you can do the same. But as a general theme, the secrecy around this stuff, I don't think helps them, in my opinion. I think one of the big coups with the Vaporfly was the paper that was published saying it was 4%.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first times that actually said, these are the elements of the shoe. They showed pictures of it, what it looked like cut up. And they said, this is what we tested, this is what we found. And I think it actually gave significant momentum to their campaign. And I don't understand, I mean, I do, but I don't agree with the relative secrecy of other companies that have subsequently said, no, we can't talk about it. Because if you don't talk about it, the assumption will be made that it's inferior to the thing that preceded it.
Mm.
Like, that's mine. When he refuses to tell exactly what the size of the performance benefit is, the skeptic in me immediately says, well, it must be less than 4% then, because otherwise you'd say it. Right?
Well, that's why I had to ask the question.
Exactly. Anyway, enough.
Yeah, we don't want to give too much
that's
away.
A general thing. Let's go through it and interrupt him regularly.
Here's Simon Lockett. So, Simon, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. When we were discussing who we should talk to around the super shoes that have come into the zeitgeist of running in the last couple of years, we thought you would be the best person because you've really been at the coalface of the development of the Adios shoe. So the first question is, what did you think when you first saw Nike's first foray into the space? And what was Adidas's kind of first thoughts around suddenly these new shoes that have now become commonplace?
So I think we've always been developing footwear year in, year out. It's a continuous cycle of, okay, how do we get better? How do we make our athletes run faster? And what can we do as a group to help them run faster? So it wasn't necessarily looking so much at what Nike were doing or any other specific brand. It was then assessing, are we on the right track with ourselves? Have we got the best ingredients for our athletes? There's been a huge shift, as we know, in the industry in the past few years, and different elements have come into different shoes and times have got faster, which is amazing.
So you're saying you didn't react to Nike's Vaporfire, Alpha Flyers, all those things?
It wasn't so much a reaction, because within ourselves, we were already trying to, you know, spin things and get things going.
But your technology was more based around lightness. The Adizero range was obviously part of that.
Yeah.
But I mean, the technology around carbon was something that potentially started with Nike that you followed. Is it wrong to say that?
If you went back in the archive, we have the Pro Plate, which was carbon. And we obviously had the Adizero Pro, before, which was a low profile boost, light strike with a carbon insert as well. So I think carbon has been in the industry for a while. And I don't necessarily think it was the carbon factor. It was low profile to high stack. Mm-hmm. Was a huge shift, I think. And that was one of the things then we adapted to, because then you start to understand, okay, we have a great shoe, say Adios Boost before, if you go back to 2014, mm-hmm. and the good times then. And trying to understand, if we then start pumping up stack heights, using different inserts, what is the performance benefit that we get back from that? So it wasn't so much a reaction, it was more an understanding of, okay, this is where it's going. And clearly, people are running fast in these shoes based on different mechanics, different geometries.
Yeah, so when I heard this for the first time, that's all quite reasonable.
Yeah.
I think there's no doubt that these companies have innovation departments and they weren't sitting on their hands for 6-7 years, right? What would be really interesting to know is whether they had a team looking at stack height before. They must have done, because like Hoka had come out with that shoe. With the stack height.
True.
And there'd also been a minimalist phase back in about 2008, 9, 10. And Adidas didn't really go for that. Then again, none of the major companies did. I think they realized you can't sell nothing. You can't sell barefoot.
They had to sell technology, because otherwise nobody would have bought a shoe.
You can't sell minimalism as much as you can sell innovation. So obviously there would have been conversations around playing around with the thickness and so on. As you mentioned, they did have a Pro Plate. So, yeah, it would be really interesting to have been a fly on the wall in their regular meetings. And this would be true of all companies, by the way, and ask, were they surprised that Nike got it or not?
Yeah. I mean, it's a classic example for those of you. I mean, most of you won't be journalists, and this is a good insight into what happens for us as journalists, is that trying to get the information out of people and get them to admit that they were basically following another trend is obviously very difficult to do. What he does make a good point about, and he actually corrected on me, is that he's quite right in saying that it was less about the carbon footplate and more about the stack height, which was important in terms of the technology.
Because,
because the carbon footplate had existed before.
Yes, and an interesting story about that is there's a guy called Darren Stephenson. He's one of the leading footwear biomechanists. I think he's out of Canada now, probably has been for a long time. And he was the guy who studied the Pro Plate initially. And the one I mentioned earlier, they'd found that the carbon plate reduced the mechanical energy loss at the metatarsophalangeal joint, basically the toe. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that trade-off. So you might save a bit of energy there, but you had the trade-off to the ankle. Mm. One of the guys who worked on their PhD under Stephenson ended up with Nike and was responsible for the development. He's named in the patent application for the Vaporfly. So there is a straight line between those two things, the carbon plate of the Adidas shoe by means of the characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And also, I remember when Oscar Pistorius was running back in, that was also 2008-09, and the whole argument around the carbon fiber blades. There was a lot of discussion then about the technology of the blades and why they were curved the way that they were, whether their stiffness was performance enhancing and gave him advantages. Obviously, they were super light, much lighter than a human limb, which Peter Weyand, who's maybe the best sprint biomechanist in the world, argued was the reason for the advantage he had. Mm. But there was discussion then about, and people literally speculated then that it was a matter of time before that curvature of carbon fiber made its way into the shoe. So these guys would definitely have known that this was on the horizon, but they didn't reach the horizon first. Nike got there.
Yeah.
Maybe by virtue of the fact that they had a midsole foam. Anyway, on we go.
Right, on we go.
Okay, how do we adapt?
Right.
And one of the big things we look at, if we go back to the Adizero Pro, is, okay, maybe had a carbon insert.
Which is just to make it clear where we are with this, that was the first sort of version of these new range of super shoes that you guys brought out.
Exactly, yeah. So it was more of a move on from where we've been in the past with full boost midsole, torsion system and things like that. And then it was understanding, actually, is boost something we should continue with in this space? Or should we try and look for other alternatives? And where we've got to is a full range is different.
So pillars. Why did you feel the need to find another alternative? What was the driver behind that?
Twofold, really. The first one was from a full range point of view, mm-hmm. because we use boost across loads of different shoes.
Yeah.
And it became really difficult to say, okay, this boost shoe's for fast running, this boost shoe's for long running, this boost shoe's for everyday running. If you walk into a store, you're like, well, I just want a boost shoe, right? At the time. So that was one thing. So we felt we needed a point of view. We needed a point of view.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you in your absence there, Simon. One point on that was, remember Boost came out with a promise that it returned more energy than any other midsole cushion at the time. Because Boost was basically TPU, this polyurethane that had been compressed into. And they had this neat, gadget gimmick that they used to demonstrate where they'd give you normal midsole material that had been rolled into a ball and Boost, and you drop them from the same height and one bounced twice the size of the other. Evidence.
Yeah. Proof is I went to the launch. I remember that. Yeah.
The interesting thing about that is the shoe was successful because Gebre Selassie ran in it, Kimeta ran in it, Emmanuel Mutai was an Adidas athlete. So they, whether it was the shoe or just the fact that they had the best five or six marathon runners, I don't know. But scientifically, the claim they made, and I remember seeing one abstract presented at a footwear conference in South America somewhere. My PhD student Nick came back to me with it. It was like a 1% difference in economy. That's smaller than the normal day-to-day variation. So it doesn't count in my scientific understanding of it, right?
Okay.
So I'm looking at that and saying they're claiming 1%. But if I measured myself every day of the week for 2 weeks, I would vary by more than a percent day-to-day for no reason other than that's just what happens.
Yeah.
So that 1% was not a worthwhile difference. Which was the difference, because then you see 4%, that's way bigger than day-to-day variation.
Mm.
And that was that's just a point.
It's an interesting one because it shows you almost the marketing speak that was involved there. You could show the difference in a bouncing piece of foam, but giving it a percentage, you're right, 1% means nothing in this grand scheme of things.
Then
but
again,
you could say there was potential advantage even on boost technology.
The problem is marketers exploit 1% because they say, the average difference between first and second is 0.5%.
Yes.
But it doesn't quite translate like that.
To the average guy at the back of the
field. Well, that, and even there, like 1% on the energy saving of a shoe doesn't necessarily mean 1% in performance improvement. Mm. And because it's smaller than the day-to-day variation, it's unlikely to have any meaningful real-world implications. And so that was, I think, a point worth making. And that's why, going back, when I remember I was in the States when the press release came out about the Vaporfly, and I remember going, another marketing claim. But 4%, that's a big marketing claim because that is large enough to make a difference. So.
Yeah. Okay, back to Simon.
We came across Lightstrike and then Lightstrike Pro. Came across, the teams were working on it for several months and years in development phase and end up with a shoe or with a foam that's super responsive, super cushioned. And if you build it with these certain geometries like we see in the Pro 1 and the Pro 2, and now the Pro 3 that you saw today, suddenly you can create this magic formula that can help someone go faster. So it was an understanding we need to try and change up a little bit, change the game in terms of what we're bringing.
So what I'm interested in is obviously there was a huge amount of hype around Boost. It was a energy return system. It was marketed as such. And that was so when you're suddenly now going, okay, we've got to make something better. How do you start the process of finding out something that's better? In other words, okay, we need to find something that's more responsive.
Yep.
How do you do that? What's the jump?
So I think it's a great question. So firstly, Boost is an amazing technology everyday running, as you mentioned, cushioned energy return. But then we wanted something that was lighter, but then had all those great properties as well. And really that is our development teams, along with our chemical engineering teams and our innovation teams, coming together and trialing, testing different foams, different properties, different compounds. And really by factor of how many things you test, you then find yourself, okay, A and B together or B and C together. It really is.
And then you come up with a cool name and suddenly you've got a new foam.
Exactly.
Because the first Adios, relatively speaking, in terms of what you would normally take to develop a shoe, was a fairly rapid 6-7 month process.
Yep.
Because you were reacting to some extent, but also accelerating because of the Olympics.
Yeah.
That development of developing new foam, there was obviously some late nights involved in that, were there?
For the team, definitely. Definitely. There was a lot of late nights, a lot of late calls with different people in different parts of the world to try and pull it off. But then what the team managed to turn around in such a short space of time was incredible.
Mm.
And that was purely based on one, trialing, but two, working with our athletes, which is such an important part of what we do. We could sit here in Herto and think we've got something amazing, but until you've got it on someone's foot and they see them run fast and they give you the direct feedback, you have no idea. So that's what the team managed to do. One, turn the whole thing around quickly and accelerate the whole project, knowing where the whole world was shifting to within this sport. But then also managing to link in with our elite athletes to say, look, believe in us, we've got something, but we need your feedback.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So this was a fascinating part of the conversation because Simon essentially, as you hear, admits that they were under some pressure to produce a shoe because their athletes, first of all, were demanding that they were able to keep up with Nike athletes. And second of all, they couldn't just produce something in a lab because they had to produce something that did work on an athlete's foot because essentially you can do a whole bunch of stuff in a lab, but unless you're actually running faster on human feet, there's no point in the technology.
Yeah, and it does sound from the way that he spoke there that they were a little bit blindsided. The fact that they needed to revisit whether their midsole cushioning was correct is a big deal. I mean, because it basically, and maybe I'm reading too much here between the lines, but they would potentially have tried to do what Nike had done with Boost midsole and then found that the shoe weighed 400 grams. Mm-hmm. So they must have said, well, okay, we can't go in this direction with these ingredients.
Mm.
And it would be interesting to know whether there was an email thread or a call or whatever it was in which someone said, where are we going to find something that performs with the same properties as that ZoomX or that PBAX material? PBAX, yeah. Because Lightstrike eventually becomes their response to it, right?
Mm. And I'm assuming they can't copy what PBAX is because there's patents involved.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to say. Remember, they came up with a carbon plate that had 5 rods.
Yes. Was different.
That seems to me like a way to get around because remember the World Athletics guideline allowed a carbon plate, but not overlapping plates. But I don't know that they could do a carbon rod because the patent application by Nike sought to protect that.
Mm.
So maybe the rods was a way around that. That would have been interesting to know, actually. Yeah. Is to what extent was this innovation lawyers or scientists?
Yes,
and athletes. Because then he talks about testing the athlete. And I've always wondered about that. I mean, you get 6 guys coming into your lab there and 6 men, 6 women. The men are 205 marathon runners. The women are 218s. And you test the shoe. Like, what are you measuring? How do you know it's working? If you find 1% improvements, you've done well. What do you measure? I wonder. Anyway. Mm.
And also, if you're training on a treadmill versus a real world situation, which is also fascinating. Yeah. Right. Let's listen more of Simon.
Did you feel pressure from athletes? Where's Adidas shoe? Because obviously, at the time, everybody was considering, well, we have to go to Nike because that shoe's got performance benefits. Therefore, you know, and there was a lot of athletes panicking in that situation because we have spoken to athletes that were sponsored by other brands, like Hoka, for instance, who took, obviously, were reacting. and they were under enormous pressure to create a product that was competitive for those athletes.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's, you know, when you work with athletes, it's about understanding, you want them to feel like we are bringing something that can help them get faster. We talk about it all the time in the past few days.
Well, at least be on a par at that point.
Well, yeah, you know, you want to give them something where they feel like they believe in us,
right?
And you want to show that we've got something and that we're now on the right path. Like we're going places.
And did you feel that pressure from the athletes? Were their questions being asked by athletes going, "Hey, guys, you need to"?
Yeah, I mean, you get a lot of questions, and you get a lot of questions. Unsure, like, okay, what are you doing? And you almost have to show your hand early with our athlete family and say, look, this is what we've got, this is what we're working on. Because you want them to feel secure and you want them to trust you as a partner as well. It should be back and forth. It isn't just, you know, a brand to an athlete. So definitely feel that. But I like to think that it never went so extreme because of the speed of the project. We managed to bring the Pro One, and suddenly everyone's like, okay, now we're in, type thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, obviously other brands have given percentage of numbers that you can be better as a runner, better efficiencies, that sort of thing. Adidas have never done that. They've never said you're 5, 6, 7, 8%, 1%, whatever, better than you would normally be. Why not?
Some of it comes down to, you know, the process of being able to claim that sort of benefit is a long process for sure. The speed of the project was quite quick, so we have to go with something. And one of the cool things we have, say with the Pro 1 and now the Pro 2, is we don't always feel we have to go with the number up front and try and convince people. Because I think by virtue of the fact that people were breaking records, topping podiums in the shoe immediately, for us was amazing validation enough. And allowed us, whilst that was happening, to then behind the scenes start working on next gen and next gen after that.
Yeah, so this is the bit, Mike, where I thought, and as I said in the intro before we even played the interview, where I feel like their lack of willingness to commit to data publicly doesn't help. Because I get what he's saying about making a claim about performance. Because remember the Vibram Five Finger shoes eventually got sued. And basically that's one of the reasons they don't exist anymore, is because they made claims around injury prevention. And then, of course, a whole bunch of people bought them and got injured. And they lost that case because they made claims that were unsubstantiated. But if you measured 15 runners in a laboratory and you measured oxygen consumption and economy and comfort and impact forces and whatever else, you could publish that in a scientific paper and not make any claims against it. But they don't even do that.
Yes, but I mean, in their defense, are we not suggesting that maybe Nike were disingenuous because their claims are 4%? Not everybody's going to get a 4% advantage.
But you see, Nike never claimed a 4% advantage. They claimed a 4% reduction in oxygen costs. And it's semantics, but it's an important semantic one. Because Nike Nike will never be on the receiving end of a runner who's actually litigating on the basis that I got the shoe and I only improved by 2.5%. Because they can very easily say, well, we made no promise that you'd get 2.5% faster. We made a promise that in 15 athletes, I don't know how many it was tested in that initial Colorado study. I'm making 15 up now. But in a group of athletes we tested the shoe on, the average reduction in oxygen cost of running was 4%. And we knew that that would be beneficial for performance.
But their marketing suggested by 4% calling the shoe the 4%, that there was always there was an improvement of 4%.
They knew that the consumer and the general population wasn't going to be discerning enough to distinguish between a 4% economy benefit and a 4% performance benefit.
Yes.
But, and so while I'm all for...
Which I find disingenuous, in all honesty, but I guess
on the part of?
In the case of Nike. Purely because, as you said, they're specifying an advantage as opposed to the marketing message, which is suggesting that there is an absolute advantage in terms of running speed and efficiency.
See, I don't see the marketing message as specifying that there's an advantage in running speed. The marketing message was that the shoe makes you 4% more economical. And if other people want to read between the lines and arrive at a 4% performance benefit incorrectly, then that's their problem. Yeah. But the point was they were transparent about it and it gave them significant credibility. I can't speak for everyone else, but the fact that it was – and then, of course, it wasn't the first paper that did the deal. It was the fact that then someone else who wasn't funded by Nike, like that first lab, came and basically repeated it. Nice, actually, this thing might be real, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if, you know, they were, it was clever of them to name it 4%.
Mm.
Because everyone thought it was a 4% performance benefit.
Mm.
But to me, the fact that other shoe companies haven't done the same, when the moment he refuses to answer that question, my, as I said, my natural deduction is it's not 4%.
No? Yeah. I guess I'm so, more believing that it was difficult for them to absolutely measure what the advantage was. And they couldn't call it 5% because that would have been, from a marketing perspective.
Why would it be difficult to measure what it was? They just have to repeat the protocol. We know exactly what was done in those first two or three studies on the Vaporfly.
Yeah.
So, and they had to have done it.
Yeah.
They had to have done it. It's basic lab testing.
So you think they would have known what the performance advantage was based
on their performance
lab?
One. The physiological advantage. They would definitely be known. They would know it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
They wouldn't have gone into production with it unless they thought it was slightly better. But the failure to commit to it relative to Nike means most people, I think, would assume that it's not as good.
Yeah. Fair point. Fair point.
Yeah.
So you knew on that first edition when the athletes were wearing that shoe and they would be competitive that you brought the shoe out that was able to now compete with your other competitor.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, that must have been a real relief.
It was a relief and it was an amazing moment for us just in terms of like this worked. And the scale of the project wasn't huge. It wasn't, you know, where we are now is so much focus and so much energy behind it. At the time, it was a super small project group that basically drop everything and go, right, we are now racing footwear. We have to pull this off.
It was like a war room of sorts, I guess.
And the team, the team involved, it's bringing each individual to the table that has, you know, experience in this field, whatever it might be. And the team that pulled that off was so, when Perez broke the record in Prague, that was a huge moment of one, validation, and two, just huge relief knowing that what we did works. And that immediately was the next, like, that was the leapfrog stage, I think.
All right, so you just heard a few moments ago, and I'm basically taking us back to the discussion we had before that a little bit. He's saying that they were relieved when Perez Chepchepche broke the world half marathon record because all the technology that they come with was now happening. Does that not support the theory that they didn't know in a lab scenario whether the shoe was going to perform better or not?
Yeah, for sure. But again, lab studies are not going to allow you to make confident performance predictions at scale.
Right.
They allow you to predict that conceptually performance will be improved because what the lab has tested is the physiological and the mechanical responses. So in the lab, they would have worked out maybe ground contact time is slightly lower, stride length is slightly higher, oxygen cost of running at 3 minutes, 24 seconds is lower than it is in their previous model of shoe. So they would have had all the data necessary to say, you know what, this shoe is making a difference to the body. And given what we know about the physiology of running, everything suggests that this athlete will perform better in the shoe. Mm. But you never know that until you test it in the only true test tube that exists, which is a race situation, right? And that's the point I was making earlier, and I don't know if it was clear, is that Nike came out with a shoe named after a physiological finding and let the world deduce what it would do for performance incorrectly. But what they've refused to effectively commit to is what their physiological finding is. And as a physiologist, again, I'm biased and maybe only 1% of the world cares, but I would love to get this shoe, the Nike one, the Brooks one, the Asics one into lab and test 20 athletes and actually make these comparisons because I'm interested in that. And there's no doubt they've got that data. In my opinion.
I'd love to see that study as well.
So do you ever feel that I just wish we'd done that first shoe? Did you ever feel that was something I wish we thought of that?
No, I don't think so. Because we know that we've always been working on projects and we've always been bringing amazing shoes. And that's not just within AdiZero. We've set benchmarks in industries where they think about Boost or Ultra Boost and all these amazing shoes across the whole range. So I don't think as a group it's ever self-pity or, oh, we should have been there or whatever. Because we knew we always could do it. We just had to focus and we did, and that's what we produced.
Yeah. Tell us about, from Adidas's perspective, if I said the word the shoe wars Do you perceive it as a shoe war with all the different brands? And I'm not talking specifically only about Nike now, because obviously lots of other brands are bringing out these carbon plated shoes, and the technology is now developing over the last couple of years. Is it a war, do you think, about who can produce the fastest shoe in the world?
Honestly, I don't take it like that, really. I think it's what we're doing. And what the whole industry is trying to do is just make the sport as best as we can. You know, we often talk about this idea of, you know, you're in a spot for a couple of years and you've got to leave it in a better place than where you found it. I think it's the old All Black saying with the jersey. And I think that's what we do, and that's what we like to think everyone else is doing as well, because you want to help improve the sport. That gets eyes on the sport, and people around the world suddenly then go, oh, marathon running's pretty cool. You know, that 10K was pretty good, or the 5K. Even today, getting texts, you know, people watching at home that don't really watch running, but suddenly you send them a link, you might enjoy this for the next 15 minutes. And suddenly everyone's like, oh, that's amazing. So I like to think the progression of technology, shoes, is just contributing to elevating the sport generally, I think.
I think initially there was always that question, and the traditionalists will tell you that the technology of shoes has ruined the human endeavor. That we've seen, obviously, world records broken, not necessarily at will, but lots of them broken over the track and particularly on the road since these super shoes came out. Just like to know what your thoughts are around that. It's probably not your direct point of concern, but do you think that the technology is taking on from, if you look at the runners of the past, Haile Gebrselassie, a prime example of that. We ran with him yesterday, what a privilege that was. But we were talking to him afterwards and we said to him, how do you feel about the fact that these shoes have come out now after you retired? And he says he's very jealous of that, because he felt that he would be 2 or 3 minutes faster and potentially could have broken the 2-hour mark for him as an athlete, which would have been a huge statement. But does it feel that technology has now become the driver rather than the athlete, taken away from what the athlete does?
I don't think so. Seeing these athletes in their hometown, whether it's in training camps in Eton or whether in Addis Ababa, what they go through on a daily basis, whether it's the early runs, cleaning their stuff, nutrition, everything. The shoes are a part of what they do. It's their tool, if you like. That's how I like to think about it. But seeing every other sacrifice they make as humans, individuals, you know, with families and all this stuff, that's their sacrifice still trumps everything, I think. We are providing them a tool that's helping them hopefully go faster at some point, and we can keep helping them push those boundaries. But I don't think it's become the driver, and I don't think it will, certainly whilst I'm doing this, for sure.
Yeah, I guess I think for a lot of traditional track and field and running people, they'll always be worried that the technology will become a technology war rather than a human war, which I guess to some extent is the fear.
Well, I think the interesting, I always, for some reason, go to like a Formula One. And I think about the progression of Formula One cars over, I don't know, the last 20 years. Like, they've got significantly faster and everything. But still, the individual talent of the driver to control it, understand it and everything.
That's true. The jury's out on that one, though, isn't it?
So if I was on the jury and I came back in on that one, I would definitely disagree with that assertion. Because I don't think you can tell whether the driver makes the difference. The only thing about Formula One that you could maybe say in redemption of that is that the driver is involved so closely in the development of the car that by the time the car makes it onto the start line of a race, the driver's actually been instrumental to the technology. So it's a partnership, it's a dance, or a collaboration, a marriage, you know? But I mean, the study to do would be to de-logo, de-identify all the cars, paint them all the same black, and then randomly allocate them to drivers for 2 years. And I guarantee you there'll be no, I almost guarantee you there'll be no predictive power based on driver performance, and all the prediction exists in the car.
But I guess the caveat to that is that all of those drivers at Formula One have reached a certain level of expertise. So there's the gaps between Lewis Hamilton versus Pierre Gasly, for instance, is probably very marginal, and the difference is actually in the car, because their ability is the same.
That's exactly the fundamental point. I mean, more than just the caveat, that's the point. And you know, the bits that he said there about the athletes still sacrifices, still trains, no one disputes that. I don't think anyone has ever said the shoe will make it
you know, the shoe will detract from the runner's contribution. The point is that the runner is now going to produce a 202 off the same physiological, psychological, emotional time and energy investment. Mm. The same sacrifice, the same training, the same nutrition is now going to be rewarded with a time 2 minutes faster than it was. And like Gebre Selassie, I don't think he would have gone sub two. I don't think the shoe helps that much. He was a generation and a set of shoes behind.
Mm.
But still, I don't know how we compare him to Kipchoge.
Mm.
You know, that's the guy whose record was broken by Kipchoge. And I suspect that those performances are probably quite similar physiologically.
Yeah. Yeah.
The difference is one guy had a shoe and the other one had iteration previous, you know. So anyway, no one's ever saying, I don't think, that it means that you can achieve it easier. It just means you can achieve a faster thing off the same. Hmm. And that skews the comparison.
Yeah. Okay.
You still need the human skill to control whatever they're in. And that's the same with running or any elite sport. You know, you could put the best footballer in the world in a certain boot. They've still got to go out there and score the free kick.
Mm.
You know, you can't control that. So I think it's definitely a part of it, but I don't think it's ever going to maybe take over.
Mm. So looking at the technology now, obviously there is limitations which have been defined by World Athletics in terms of the height of the sole of the shoe, et cetera, et cetera. If those limitations weren't there and you had a completely open sheet of paper and you said, right, we can do whatever we like here, is it possible to create something that would just blow the lights out? I mean, do the restrictions on World Athletics curtail some of the technology that you could bring in, for instance?
I think there's two things. I think one, you know, take our Primex.
Yes, which is an example. Effectively an illegal shoe, isn't it?
Totally. From compared to World Athletics, yeah. 50 millimeters, double rods, double foam, throwing everything at it, and it's an amazing shoe.
Yeah.
But within this team, I think the World Athletics regulations are there for a reason, so that, you know, there is some sort of level. But I also think it flips it, because I think technology has to become smarter and has to become better, if I think cushioning or energy return, within those limitations. So actually, in the long run, you might find that you're discovering better technologies because you have to focus and have to make things work within a rule set. Yeah. If that rule isn't there, maybe you're not as focused.
Yeah.
Maybe you're talking hypothetical, but still, I think it's quite an interesting, when you have that, okay, you've got all this, but you do it within this box, then you start to challenge yourself and become very creative on how you build things, engineer things, which I think feels like quite a nice challenge.
Yes, I'm interrupting him this time because I want to know from you whether because you were face to face across the table from the guy, and did you get the impression that because he answered it very wisely and considerately with great thought, but did you get the impression they welcomed the restrictions? Or did he say anything off air that gave you any insight beyond that answer?
No, what you hear is what questions I asked him, but I think generally, having spent 3 days there, there was some, I guess there was a sense that the restrictions and the controls were better because it allowed, something wasn't going to come out of left field.
Mm.
There was an overriding sense that Nike weren't going to develop some new technology that was just going to come out of the left field and suddenly obliterate everybody again.
Yeah.
So I guess that, there was probably an undertone of that.
Yeah. So it's a safer, it's a safer place now because of the boundaries that have been created.
Yeah.
And certainly when World Athletics announced them, aside from what you alluded to earlier, where they set it almost exactly at the point that would permit the existing shoe, it was a good step. In my opinion, it wasn't sufficient because they allowed it to be 40 mils. They could have come down to 30 or 27 or whatever it was, you know. But anyway, as a principle, I think I probably agree with them.
Yeah. Mm. So, I mean, you're obviously working probably right now on technology and shoes that are going to come out in 18 months to maybe even 2 years. Is that the sort of lead time? And would we see what you're starting to think about now in 2024, 25?
From within our team, we work on similar timelines, on those timelines. More in terms of trying to think what's next. I think as a rule within Adi creation, it's never standing still. It's always, okay, you saw the Pro 3 today. Okay, but How would we make that better?
Mm.
And there's always this rolling thing of, okay, how are we going to get better? How are we going to make it faster?
And is there a point where you can't make it any better? I suppose that's always, is that something you consider? Is the shoe maxed out?
The Pro 3 is an incredible shoe, but I still think we can, I still think, you know, a few years down the line, if you give people more time, the right people more time, maybe you can keep pushing those boundaries. But within Adidas as well, we have such an amazing innovation team who are thinking further ahead. And that's not just based on tech, because the tech, you know, you've got to keep going with, but it's trying to understand how, what the runner will be like in 6, 7, 8 years. What will the
So you're even thinking that far down the line?
From an innovation point of view, thinking really far ahead as to where the direction of the brand will go, where the direction of running footwear will go. Because then you have to build, you know, if you understand, or you try and think about maybe the runner in that timeline, again, it's difficult to think that far ahead. You're really far into the future. But yeah, that's where, you know, always thinking about those next steps and those next milestones that you potentially achieve.
What do you think the future of running shoes looks like in terms of, well, let's talk, maybe split it into two. What does the future of performance shoes look like versus the everyday shoe for somebody like me, for instance, who won't run in a Primex because it's pointless?
You should give it a try. I think, you know what? I think everyday running, if you take what we've maybe learned over the past 5, 10, 15 years, comfort is a word that is should be synonymous with any shoe. No one's picking an uncomfortable shoe for sure.
Because that's all about the point of sale when you're
I think
selling a shoe to somebody that's got to feel comfortable when they put it on, don't they?
Exactly. I mean, we think about it as big, different stages of moments of truth.
Mm.
The first moment of truth is the first time you see a shoe. The second moment might be picking it up. Third might be putting it on. And that element of comfort and that super soft step in, I don't think is going to change because people are always going to want that, I think. So for everyday running, I think it's that. Maybe it gets lighter. Maybe you try to build something that's super soft, plush, you know. I think from a racing point of view.
Do you think shoes have become, and I've noticed this on Runner's World, shoes have become less controlled. So, you know, in the 1990s, you had motion control shoes, which don't exist anymore. Now you have stability, and most shoes are neutral now, aren't they, really?
You would have a lot of, yeah, I mean, there's definitely fewer control shoes. A lot of stability or support today comes through, I think comes through stability through geometries.
Mm.
So wider platforms, maybe some higher stack heights, which give you that more cushioning. So you've got higher stack cushioning on a wider platform, like our Adistar, for example. That is today's answer to maybe yesterday's stability issue.
Yeah.
Because it allows more people to step into maybe one shoe as opposed to having multiple things to choose from.
Yeah, so you've got neutral loss, but the stability comes from other factors within the shoe.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're not naming it as a stability shoe.
No.
It's kind of something unsexy about that, isn't it?
Yeah. It's hard to put it, you know, in a certain box on a wall, but even how you build a medial side of an upper can impact someone's perception of how they think if that shoe's stable or not. It could be the same platform, but you can have a totally different medial side upper.
Mm.
It fits very differently. Someone thinks that one's a neutral, that's a stable.
Yeah.
So I actually think comfort, maybe wider platforms and maybe a bit more of a universal fit potentially, making this up to be honest. We don't know what's going to happen in 5, 10 years.
What is a universal fit?
More the idea of like stable through geometries.
Right.
So not necessarily building all out true stable shoes, maybe more in this neutral stable world potentially.
Personalized? Is there any future in personalized shoes that can be personalized to your foot in some way?
I think as a platform and an innovation, 4D, if I think about what we have within the range, 4D is certainly...
For those of you who don't know what that looks like, it's like a lattice construction in the sole, isn't it?
Exactly. So it's built from essentially athlete data and runner data that goes into constructing a midsole that we can print. Right. So it's not the traditional way of building a mold, and then you open the mold and you take it out. You actually almost grow it. So you can tune through programs the different lattice structures where you have support, where you don't have support.
So in other words, potentially down the line, I could go into a store or an Adidas something and say, they'd test my shoe or my foot and they would say, right, this person needs more support. You create a lattice shoe which has more support in certain areas. So the sole becomes bespoke to you as a runner. Is that what you're saying?
That I mean,
potentially,
essentially,
yeah.
Why not? I mean, that's a pretty cool idea. Yeah. And that's what 40 has always been based on, is this idea of it's coded for the runner. At the minute, the runner is, you know, 40 Ford that we have in the market.
I mean, for you as somebody at the head of this, I mean, it's obviously something that must be quite exciting. That how do you create this ultimate bespoke shoe? I suppose that is the holy grail of running shoes to some extent, isn't it?
It could be a super interesting one thing to happen, and two, challenge for a team to, okay, how would we do this?
Mm.
How would you do it at scale? How would you do it in stores, different locations?
Mm.
But I certainly think 40 years of tech is amazing, innovative, forward thinking is certainly on that path of more a midsole coded for a runner right now. And then you take out that runner and whoever in the future potentially.
Because we've seen stuff in cycling where you get a foam that you can put in a cycling shoe, you put it in the microwave for 30 seconds, you put it in the shoe, you stand on it and it cools to the shape of your foot.
Yeah.
Which is interesting in cycling that it happens, but I've never seen that in running, which is bizarre because it feels like a natural thing in running that could happen.
You know? Yeah, I'm unsure. I mean, I've bought a lot of cycling shoes in the past. And I guess, you know, back to like universal, which is a broad topic, but I guess maybe the platform is maybe quite standard within those. So a midsole, insole, sorry, gives you a bit more personalized feeling.
Yeah.
Whereas if you buy a running shoe and put a running shoe on, your foot can adapt to the different foams, the different cushioning technologies. I think the impact is very different, obviously, from a running cycling perspective. Yeah.
Well, Simon, thanks very much for your time. I think you've got the kind of job that most of us would love to have. I think the guys from the Innovation Lab themselves have amazing jobs. I mean, do you love going to work every day? It's challenging, I guess, and scary, but also great fun.
It's incredible. And to think, you know, you've been here for the past few days as well. This is an amazing place to work. One, the campus is incredible. And just to come in with this team, have these products on the table and knowing what we're trying to cook and what we're trying to change and where we go forward. It's pretty spectacular. And I've, you know, been a part of Adidas for nearly 8 years and been with Global just over 2. And I still feel like a little kid when you get a new sample or a new prototype or someone sends you a picture of what we've done here. Yeah. And then to think an athlete will wear it in a race, that's a pretty special connection and feeling. So yeah, it's amazing.
I guess it's like, you know, when you start with that embryonic diagram on a whiteboard and then you said city on the shoes of the runners we've seen this morning.
Yeah,
it must be really satisfying.
Yeah, when you speak to design development, say, okay, we want to make a fast 5-10k shoe, and you go through all your spiel that you've been practicing, your presentation, this is why we need to do XYZ, and then you produce, you know, or the team produces a Takumi Sen 8 that goes on to
be I've got those things on right now, and I'll tell you what, they are spectacular.
Yeah, exactly.
Even for a lard ass like myself. Simon, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Cool. So yeah, that was the interview with Simon. Fascinating to talk a little bit at the end of that around what he sees the future of technology looking like. And I asked him about, you know, development of bespoke shoes. I know there is some talk about that with their particular brand of shoe, their forward shoes that they have. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to think what would happen 10 years down the line, 5 years down the line. Would you be able to walk into a shop and get a shoe that is made specifically for your foot? I think that time must come. That must be the next step, I would think, in shoe development.
Yes, and I think also comfort and injury prevention are probably the end goals of whatever iterations come next, because the boundaries that have been created around shoes now, I think, have closed off the degree to which we can advance performance, unless there's another new foam, you know, but I would consider that evolution, not revolution. But maybe what you asked him about there at the end is the key. And, you know, it's interesting, even on these shoes, I always thought the most interesting thing, and moving forward, the most concerning thing is the responder, non-responder issue. Amazingly, in the first batch of studies, the first 2 or 3 studies, they didn't document non-responders to the shoe. Everyone got better. Some of them got better by 1%, which, as I mentioned, is probably 0. Some of them got better by 8%. I've subsequently seen a study on recreational runners, you know, the likes of you and I, where there are non-responders to these carbon bouncy shoes, super shoes. So quite clearly that's going to happen. The aforementioned Nick Tam, who is now working in the shoe industry, did his PhD on barefoot running and shod running. And we found the same thing there. Some athletes, you took the shoes off and they changed their foot strike pattern instantly without instruction. Other athletes, 8 weeks of barefoot training with lots of instruction, still couldn't do it. They still landed on the heel. And when you... when you go and you look at the research that was being published at the time that Nick started his PhD, nobody was recognizing that. You know, the Dan Lieberman had come out with a paper on barefoot versus shod running and presented averages. But when you explored the stats of that, you saw he had the same thing.
Mm.
And so I do feel a little bit that the shoe industry has given short shrift to individual differences in the past because it's too difficult to cater to every single individual. But what you asked him about there, I think that might be the next technological breakthrough. The only challenge, and I'll wrap up with this, is injury, for instance, is so complex. There's a chain of interconnected parts, joints, muscles, tendons, movements, forces, that is so complex that I don't know that you can accurately target design of a shoe to solve an injury when we don't really have confidence around the cause in the first place. But that's likely where the next innovation goes, if we can join the dots and solve that problem.
Well, let us know what you think about our debate today about the shoe technology, and where do you think shoe technology is going to go, particularly in running. You know, maybe you have some ideas, and let us know what you think about what the future looks like in terms of running and technology. And keep an eye on our show for next week. We're going to be bringing you two new features. We're going to have a special section for our patrons. We're going to ask our patrons to tell us what they're thinking about, and maybe we can discuss what they're going to be considering, and we're going to call it Patrons Ponder. So all of our patrons, if you're listening to this, think about questions that you'd like to ask us, things that you've seen in the media, and questions that you'd like to discuss on our podcast. And secondly, we're going to be discussing recent papers that have come out with Ross, and we're going to take a paper from some of the many papers that get delivered every single week virtually, and we're going to take one of those, and Ross is going to analyze it and give us a bit of a expert view on it.
Or something in the news. I mean, like it's French Open. Maybe something really interesting happens in the tennis, and so we'll call the segment Caught My Eye, and either Mike or I will say something caught my eye this week, and we'll spend a few minutes just chatting about it.
Exactly. So a bit of a revamped show for next week. We look forward to seeing you and speaking to you then. Goodbye.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.